Hello and welcome to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. I'm your host, Robert Stride, and Men's Magazines focuses on the arts, culture, commentary, and in-depth news reporting as found in both the domestic and the international editions of GQ, Esquire, and Men's Health. In this edition for the third week of April 2024, with the Masters Golf Tournament about to begin, the warring members of the PGA and LIV Golf are setting down their sabers and competing together, for 4 days at least, for that big Masters trophy, that much-coveted green jacket, and an elite place in golf history. Some people love LIV, the Saudi-led effort to enliven and modernize golf. Others see that venture far more cynically as an effort to sports wash away the stains of Saudi Arabia's awful human rights record and the export of Wahhabism, the Saudi state's ultra-Orthodox version of Islam. Wherever you come down on these questions, you may be interested to know that Saudi Arabia is making a similar financial and cultural push into professional soccer. This week's show explores the phenomenon and the effort by billionaires of all stripes to buy pro sports teams as business investments, as rarefied status symbols, and as image makeovers of their own. We will begin with Can the Saudis Buy Soccer? And proceed to How to Buy a Pro Sports Team, in case you too wish to own your own team. Both articles were published this spring in GQ. Before we begin, though, I should mention that Men's Magazines includes adult content and, on occasion, language which some might find offensive. Having said that, I encourage you to sit back, relax, and enjoy Men's Magazines. Saudi Arabia is spending an unfathomable fortune to lure the biggest stars of global football, Ronaldo, Benzema, Neymar, to its upstart league. So GQ ventured to the kingdom to discover what the gambit represents. Is this the future of the world's most popular sport, the vanguard of sports washing, or something way bigger? Can the Saudis Buy Soccer? By Oliver Franklin Wallace. Consider, before we begin, that not long ago the grassy pitch of Riyadh's Al Awl Park was desert, and even before that it was underwater. Around 250 million years ago, give or take, much of what we call the Arabian Peninsula was submerged beneath an ancient sea that teemed with life, algae, diatoms, and sundry other prehistoric critters in their trillions. When these creatures died, their bodies littered the ocean floor and became trapped. Bedrock accreted, tectonic plates drifted, smashed together, and under pressure and heat and time, those organisms transformed into the substance we now know as crude oil. Whole eras pass, the dinosaurs come and go, continents break up, sea levels fall, and a new landmass rises from the waves, eventually giving way to an inhospitable desert. The resourceful Homo sapiens that do make it their home toil and quarrel until the early 20th century, when much of the territory falls into the hands of the warrior they call Ibn Saud, who proclaims his fiefdom the new kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Then, fortune. Prospectors discovered that the bygone ocean has left behind some of the richest oil and gas reserves anywhere on the planet, making the ruling family of this fledgling desert kingdom among the wealthiest human beings alive. The point being that places change, slowly, continuously, and on rare occasion all at once. Oh, and that for the craziness of what follows to make sense, perhaps keep in mind that while money doesn't grow on trees, it does, in a few places, flow freely from the earth. Present day. Where once was only rock and dirt, now stands a state-of-the-art soccer stadium, and on this balmy Friday night in Riyadh, a game night in the Saudi Pro League, fans of the home side, Al Nassr, are arriving en masse. Outside the stadium, a group of what might be the world's most polite soccer ultras have formed a human tunnel and are singing songs, handing out candy and free jerseys. On the concourse, fans wearing yellow and blue scarves over traditional Saudi thobes and abayas queue for coffee and popcorn, chattering excitedly about the chance to see their new superstar. Even now, they can't believe it. Cristiano Ronaldo, the 5-time Champions League winner and contender for soccer's best ever player, here in Saudi Arabia. The GOAT, the greatest of all time, come to my favorite club? Gaida Khaled, an Al Nassr fan, says, her eyes gleaming from behind her hijab. History is written right now. The fans here in Saudi, like the wider soccer world, are still in disbelief over Ronaldo's arrival, even a year on since the Portuguese forward left Europe to sign a contract reportedly worth over $200 million annually with Al Nassr, a mid-sized club in the Saudi Pro League. While fading stars have been tempted to the Middle East over the years with offers of palaces and Scrooge McDuck money, none had ever been as celebrated or as decorated. Whereas another player might have been written off as a 37-year-old chasing one last payday, this was something bigger. After decades of isolation, Saudi Arabia, now under its crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, is undertaking a rapid transformation as part of a national effort to reshape the kingdom into a global economic power and wean itself off its financial dependence on oil. As part of this effort, called Vision 2030, the government has spent billions on tourism-friendly projects like NEOM, a futuristic new megacity on the Red Sea, as well as making audacious investments in sports, including golf, Formula One, boxing, tennis, and the America's Cup. Critics have called its sports investment sports washing, an attempt to use sports' mass appeal to distract from the regime's human rights abuses. MBS has dismissed those claims, saying, if sports washing is going to increase my GDP by way of 1%, then I will continue doing sports washing. Either way, soccer, with its unmatched global audience, is seen as the Saudis' greatest prize, and so the regime has set out to transform the Pro League from a competitive backwater into a rival for England's Premier League or Spain's La Liga as one of the best in the world. Ronaldo turned out to be just the opening salvo. Last June, 6 months after his signing, the Public Investment Fund, which controls Saudi Arabia's sizable sovereign wealth, took a majority stake in four of the kingdom's biggest soccer teams, Al Nassr, Al Ittihad, Al Ahly, and Al Hilal. The investment triggered a wild shopping spree. Al Ittihad signed the French striker Karim Benzema, then holder of the Ballon d'Or from Real Madrid. Riyad Mahrez, a reigning Champions League winner at Manchester City, signed for Al Ahly. Bayern Munich's Sadio Mane joined Ronaldo in a growing cast of all-stars at Al Nassr. Every other day, it seemed a player from one of Europe's most esteemed clubs was boarding a flight to the kingdom to sign for teams that, just a few weeks earlier, most of them had probably never heard of. While European clubs have, from time to time, spent millions assembling super teams, Real Madrid during its two Galacticos eras, or present-day Manchester City, for example, this was something new. Nobody had ever tried to sign a whole league before. The whole thing seemed to pose deeper existential questions about sports, human rights, and fandom. Would players really want to move to an unknown team in an unknown league in a country not exactly known for its warm welcome? Would anyone actually watch the games? And perhaps more to the point, should they? If you're thinking that Saudi Arabia seems a somewhat odd place for a league dedicated to the world's most popular grass sport, well, you have a point. It's not just that summer temperatures can reach 120 degrees Fahrenheit or that part of the country is blanketed by the biggest continuous sand desert on Earth. The kingdom lacks a single river, so it draws much of its water for, say, irrigating soccer pitches from the sea, whereupon it must be desalinated in huge industrial plants. Buildings tend to be aggressively air-conditioned. When outdoor sports are played at all, they tend to be late at night after dark. Even then, temperatures on the pitch in the early season can hit over 100 degrees. Still, the first impression you get upon arriving in Riyadh, the Saudi capital, is not of heat, but of cranes. The city is forested with them, as if a sketch artist had roughed out a skyline and everyone else is now tasked with filling it in. The tinnitus hum of construction is everywhere. You can't seem to drive three blocks without encountering signage teasing some new development. An impossibly tall skyscraper, a new entertainment district, an upscale housing complex illustrated with 3D mock-ups of smiling, uncovered people of all races and genders living in harmony. Along the brand new highways, images of the crown prince and his father, King Salman, stare down from billboards, looking stoic. It's tradition in Saudi to display a portrait of the king in your home or business, so everywhere you go, shops, restaurants, random hotel lobbies, you find yourself under his beneficent gaze, which, having considered the ramifications of objecting, I, of course, find a totally chill and non-authoritarian state thing to do. But then, this is the new Saudi Arabia, a freer, generally more easygoing place to be. Since MBS took de facto control in 2017, life has changed immeasurably. Women can now go out with their hair uncovered, play sports unrestricted, even drive. The religious police that once roamed the streets harassing citizens have been stripped of their power. At the same time, MBS has solidified control of the security services, imprisoning enemies and at one point locking up hundreds of the country's elite, including some of his relatives and courtiers, converting the Riyadh Ritz-Carlton into a luxury prison. Justice Square, once known as Chop Chop Square for being the official site of public beheadings, has been redeveloped as a charming pedestrian plaza, complete with a bookstore and hipster coffee shop. The only hint of its gruesome past is the large covered drain at its center. The execution still happened, but out of sight. The Riyadh headquarters of the Saudi Pro League lie in Al-Falah, a dusty neighborhood of sandblasted apartment buildings and empty lots in the north of the city. I'd expected grandeur, but the office itself is typical of any sports organization, all world maps and soccer paraphernalia, and staffed by an assortment of young and smiling faces. A publicist tells me the HQ will soon be moving to a nicer building. The only real sign we're not in Paris or Geneva is the stack of prayer mats in the corner. The architect of the SBL's superstar acquisition strategy is Michael Eminalo, a charming, slimly built Nigerian who previously worked as the technical director of Chelsea at a time when the London club's recruitment was the envy of world soccer. Mohamed Salah, Kevin De Bruyne, Eden Hazard. Eminalo signed them all. He was persuaded to join the Saudi project, he says, by a masterful 7-minute pitch from the Saudi sports minister, Prince Abdulaziz bin Turki Al Saud, who explained to him the country's ambition to turn the SPL into one of the world's top 10 soccer leagues. This has not been done just to get hype, Eminalo says, taking a seat behind a desk. It's been done to have a lasting impact, and for it to have lasting impact, it means that it won't operate as just a project for the league. It'll operate as a project for the development of football in its entirety in the kingdom. Reshaping the SPL was not an overnight decision. Long before Ronaldo signed, the league commissioned Deloitte, an official told me, to draw up a plan for overhauling the country's soccer infrastructure. Ronaldo just accelerated things. Still, Aminalo is the first to admit that last summer got slightly out of hand. I wouldn't say that we did the best job in terms of controlling the narrative, he says. That might be an understatement. The money on offer was, even by soccer's standards, absolutely bananas. Benzema was said to be getting $218 million per year. To put that in context, Stephen Curry's NBA-leading deal with the Golden State Warriors is worth $51.9 million a year. Even lesser stars were fetching huge sums. Former Liverpool midfielder Jordan Henderson was supposedly earning about $450,000 a week. Then there were the perks, with players reportedly being offered houses complete with staff, free flights, schooling for their kids, and luxury cars with their own drivers. Before the Brazilian megastar Neymar signed with Al Hilal, British tabloids claimed that his contract demands had included a Bentley, an Aston Martin, a Lamborghini, and a never-ending supply of acai juice. When Neymar eventually did sign, the Saudis sent a private Boeing 747, reportedly owned by a prince, to convey him to Riyadh, where he was met by delirious crowds. Somehow, even more unbelievable were the players the SPL failed to sign. Al Ittihad reportedly offered about $190 million for Liverpool's Mo Salah. The club also tried to prize Kevin De Bruyne, arguably the world's best midfielder, from Manchester City. Al Hilal supposedly offered a package worth more than $1.5 billion to Lionel Messi, reportedly already making approximately $25 million as a tourism ambassador for the kingdom before he spurned the Saudi League in favor of MLS's Inter Miami. When Messi turned them down, Al Hilal unsuccessfully offered Paris Saint-Germain a world-record $332 million transfer fee for Kylian Mbappe. "We needed to get everybody's attention," Aminalo says. The challenge at the time was that some of the Saudi clubs were not yet well equipped to scout superstars or negotiate with powerful agents. They started spending very quickly, Aminalo says. As time went on, it became clear that some, I believe, could have signed a really legacy-defining player for their clubs, but they had spent their budget. When you're attempting to transform the soccer culture of an entire nation, there's more to scouting prospective players than key passes or expected goals. The number one KPI is performance on the pitch, Aminalo says. After that, it's what kind of societal impact is this player going to have? We're talking about cultural impact within the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. When kids tune in, we have to make sure that their parents are not scared that the player is going to misbehave. The aim, he says, is not only to sign superstars, but ambassadors to tell good stories about what we're doing here so that other people want to come and join. When a club wants to sign a star player, Aminalo and his department review the terms. If the team has the money and they decide the player is worth the fee, the process is simple. If it's a superstar, it's easy. Yes, a no-brainer, he says. After that, he says, the deal can be scrutinized by higher authorities. If it gets to the stakeholders above my pay grade, or Saad's pay grade, SPL Interim CEO Saad Al-Laziz, and if they want to review it, they can do so. Who those stakeholders are, or where the transfer budgets ultimately come from, nobody seems eager to say. The league's financial structure is complicated. The SPL's title sponsor, the real estate developer Roshan, chaired by the Crown Prince, is owned by the Public Investment Fund, also chaired by the Crown Prince. A number of the league's other major sponsors are also owned in part or run by the government, and while the government, through the PIF, holds a truly dizzying portfolio of investments, its fortunes are inevitably underpinned by the kingdom's oil reserves, currently thought to comprise some 260 billion barrels. As long as the world is still hooked on oil, the money might as well be limitless. At least officially, however, the plan is that the SPL will eventually pull its own weight. The strategy isn't where you get the money, as long as you ensure that you're monetizing the league. The SPL's chief operating officer, a former WWE executive named Carlo Nora, tells me. But most significantly, the influx of players has delivered the eyeballs, which has made it a viable product for us to go to market, whether it's regional, domestic, or international. That so many players declined the bounteous riches on offer underlines the difficulties facing the Saudi project. After the young Spanish midfielder, Gabri Vega, signed for Al Ahly, the Real Madrid legend, Toni Kroos, posted that it was embarrassing and told the German edition of Sports Illustrated that he would never move to Saudi Arabia because of the lack of human rights. Other stars made no secret of the fact they turned down Saudi offers. And let's face it, Saudi Arabia doesn't exactly have the greatest track record on human rights. Its less than excellent reputation has only worsened since 2018, when Saudi operatives murdered and dismembered the Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi inside the country's consulate in Istanbul. While U.S. intelligence agencies have concluded that MBS approved the operation that killed Khashoggi, the Crown Prince himself has denied giving the order, telling The Atlantic, not entirely reassuringly, that if that's the way we did things, Khashoggi would not even be among the top 1,000 people on the list. Despite recent reforms, it's still a country where homosexual acts are illegal, alcohol is forbidden, and where dissidents are routinely jailed or executed. As the golfer Phil Mickelson said in an interview shortly before taking a Saudi contract reported to have been worth around $200 million, they're scary motherfuckers. Even so, by the end of August, 94 overseas players had agreed to join the Saudi Pro League at a combined cost of some $957 million, according to Deloitte Sports Business Group. Attracted by their new stars, dozens of broadcasters, including Fox Sports, signed up to air league matches internationally. If players did have concerns, Emanalo says, they didn't tell him. Nobody ever asked the question, am I going to be safe? That didn't come up, he says. Maybe they asked their agents. In a way, the number of players who did end up accepting the Saudi money shouldn't be that surprising. Given the geography of the global game, the idea that an athlete would end up in the Middle East is not much weirder than playing for a team in Manchester or Munich. As Fabio Henrique Tavares, the Brazilian midfielder better known as Fabinho, tells me, on the pitch, everyone speaks the same language. The muezzin is calling the faithful to prayer when I arrive at Al Ittihad's training complex in Jeddah on the kingdom's western coast. The summer heat has ebbed away and the breeze is rolling in off the Red Sea. Inside an empty conference room, the club, perhaps unused to dealing with journalists, has set up a little table with national flags, as if preparing for a visit by a foreign dignitary. Fabinho joined Al Ittihad from Liverpool in July, having won every major title in England and before that the French League One with AS Monaco. I think because I'm used to moving to different countries, different cultures, it was easy for me and my wife, he says. When Fabinho's agent first told him about Al Ittihad's interest, he was unsure. He texted a friend who had played in Saudi, Elder Costa, who reassured him about the lifestyle, and then he saw the contract offer. A really good contract, he says, grinning. He, his wife, and their baby have been living in a hotel downtown while their new place is being finished. I still need to buy the furniture, he says. His fellow new Al-Ittihad signings, Jota and N'Golo Kante, are, he says, both living in the hotel too. Such an arrangement isn't uncommon. Ronaldo, when he moved to Riyadh, was reported to have stayed at a $300,000 a month kingdom suite at the Four Seasons before moving to a private compound in the suburbs. Some of the Brits at Al Attifaq, based in the eastern city of Dammam, were said to have moved their families over the border in Bahrain, where there are better international schools and alcohol is legal. There are things you have to get used to, Fabino says. The roads here, which are crazy. The club gifted him a Mercedes-Benz when he arrived, but the first day he drove, he got into a bender and so now travels with the driver. Which might explain why, when Karim Benzema arrives later here at the training ground driving a yellow Lamborghini Urus, he is accompanied by the flashing lights of what appears to be a police escort. The heat is undeniable, particularly in summer. Sometimes you cannot put the intensity in that we had in England because of the weather, Fabino says. The heat means training happens in the evening instead of the morning, as it does in Europe. Doing well in the SPL means competition in the Asian equivalent of the Champions League, which requires traveling to play in countries like Uzbekistan and Iran, where the facilities can leave a lot to be desired. Otherwise, it's not too bad. A little harder to see friends and family back in Brazil. We are used to being, I can say, more alone, he says. Sometimes my wife said some things, the way she dressed maybe needed to change. But the way I see it, the way I live here, is amazing. Some players have found the change liberating. Alain Saint-Maximin, a French winger, joined Jeddah's Al Ahly this last summer from Newcastle United, a team now majority owned by the PIF. The nocturnal schedule, he explains, allows him to use the daytime hours to focus on other pursuits. I have my brand. I have a board game, clothing, jewelry, many things, Saint-Maximin says, lounging on a sofa in the Al Ahly training ground across town. I'm not the type of person to, like, just stay on the sofa. That's not me. And then there's the money. Saint-Maximin grew up poor on the outskirts of Paris. It was difficult for me to be able to go to buy stuff, to be able to have a normal life like the people who have money, you know? I was worried about what I was going to eat, he says. So he's less coy than some about talking about it. I asked for the money I wanted. It was a big fight, but they gave me exactly what I asked and what I think I deserve to have. Tabloids put Saint-Maximin's Al Ahly contract at $12.7 million per year. Those reports aren't accurate, he says, but that's kind of beside the point. In your work, if they come and say, okay, we'll give you $50 million in 3 years, it's impossible to not be happy about it. For sure, I feel good here, not only about the money, but about everything, the life, the people, everything. And we must pause here for station identification. You're listening to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. And now back to our piece on the Saudi investment in professional soccer. Each player moved for their own reasons. Of course, it's a lot of money, but as a football player, you're always making good money, Aleksandar Mitrovic, a Serbian striker for Al Hilal, tells me. Mitrovic signed last summer after 6 seasons with the London club Fulham, bouncing between the Premier League and the Championship, England's second tier. Don't get me wrong, I loved the club, but after 6 years, it's hard, you know? I play in the Premier League, get relegated, get promoted. I was 2 times top scorer in the Championship, broke the goal-scoring record, he says. I never had a chance to play for top teams, so when this club came, it was giving me something that I always wanted. Sure, it's different, but you know what? Right now, Al Hilal are top of the league, and Mitrovic is second in the scoring charts. I love it here, to be honest, he says. So far, so good. Not every player has settled in as easily. In January, there were widespread reports that some of the league's new superstars, including Benzema and Al Ahly's Roberto Firmino, were unhappy and trying to secure moves back to Europe. The English midfielder, Jordan Henderson, terminated his lucrative contract with El-Etifak to move to Ajax in the Netherlands after just 6 months, supposedly struggling with the low quality of play, the paltry fan attendance, and the challenges of adapting to life in the country. Still, all the players I meet seem happy and contented. Of course, it'd be easy to write off their comments to me as inauthentic or practiced. After all, in a country where even tweeting something critical of the Royals can result in a jail sentence or worse, it's not like they're going to say anything negative. Hell, even asking the players about Saudi's human rights record could be seen as defaming the government and therefore a jailable offense. And so, being a coward and not wanting anyone else to say anything that might get them in trouble, I don't even ask. But then, that's the power of authoritarianism. Silence enough people, and the rest will silence themselves. Nearly a year after signing Ronaldo, the Saudis actually built him a shrine. The CR7 Signature Museum is located in Boulevard City, one of Riyadh's new shopping and entertainment districts, where for a small fee, fans in thobes and Al Nasser scarves can gaze at a hall of Ronaldo's real trophies, take photos with a dubiously convincing waxwork, and even measure their own shooting power and vertical jump against Cristiano's before heading home with a signed poster. I don't see anybody beat Ronaldo's record, but then most of the people trying are children. If you want to see the new Saudi Arabia, there's no better place than Boulevard City. The place is overwhelming. 220 acres of Western chains and American fast food joints like Burger King, Baskin Robbins, Chuck E. Cheese. There's a go-kart track and a virtual reality arena. We walk through a giant, brightly lit imitation of Times Square to Boulevard Studios, where visitors are welcomed on a huge red carpet leading past an homage to the Warner Brothers Tower and the world of Barbie, to the Piece de Resistance, a genuine Disney castle, the first in the Middle East, for which kids are queuing excitedly. All this in a country in which cinemas were banned as recently as 2017. Nearby, someone manning a fairground game yells in perfect English, "All right, guys, we have a winner." Is this not, reader, the meaning of progress? Families walking hand in hand, smiling, buying happily the best of what the free market has to offer? It's strangely beautiful. It's also deeply uncanny. Not to see Saudi teens queuing inside Starbucks or giggling outside the Five Nights at Freddy's Experience, but the undeniable physical sensation that this is all so precarious. One can only imagine the energy consumption, the sheer feat of engineering required to build this place. Everything glows. In the food court, a giant fountain periodically puts on musical light shows. We are in the desert. Beside Boulevard City stands Boulevard World, a theme park that features the world's largest man-made lagoon and a recreation of the pyramids and a giant Chinese temple and what appears to be a smaller version of the Las Vegas Sphere. Nearby, workers are putting the finishing touches on Al Hilal's new 26,000-seater Kingdom Arena, which is air-conditioned and features a retractable roof, allowing sporting events to be played even in extreme heat. Man won, nature zero. But then, this is the kingdom's power. While we schmucks in the West are freaking out about climate change, here, growth continues unabated. All of this is running on oil and gas that, despite the country's public climate commitments, Saudi's future relies on perpetuating demand for. The money comes out of the ground. At the boulevard, I notice that everything is being watched by countless CCTV cameras. I've been told the system is so cutting edge, it could spot someone who so much as clenches their fist. True or not, that's either a comfort in a country with a history of terror threats or a troubling allegory for something. According to Amnesty International, Saudi Arabia executed 196 people in 2022, a reported 30-year high. Anyway, the brands are all here, and business is booming. Back at Al Owl Park, warm-ups are finished and kickoff is approaching. Overhead, floodlights stain the night sky purple as fans trickle into the half-empty seats. The turnout is a concern. By mid-season, the SPL project was already being dogged by reports of dire fan attendance. In October, El Etifak, with its expensive cast of international signings, played Al Riyadh in front of just 696 fans. When Al Riyadh played Al Khalij in Riyadh, only 144 people turned up. Explanations given so far include ticketing problems and the league's new schedules conflicting with prayer times. Tonight's opponent, Al Akdud, has a simpler excuse. Its home city, Najran, is a 10-hour drive across the desert, so it's perhaps not surprising that I don't see a single away fan all evening. Still, the seats are about 90% full as the announcer reads out the teams. When Ronaldo emerges from the tunnel, the place goes wild. Everyone is here for him. All my friends, even those not interested in football, now they're interested because we have Cristiano, Gaida Khaled, the Al Nasser fan, says. Khaled being here at all is still new. Women have been able to attend soccer games in the kingdom only since 2018. Before, we couldn't come to the football, explains Salpi Yoshkashjian, another fan, here with her 14-year-old daughter. They're Armenian-Lebanese, but Yoshkashjian has lived in the kingdom for 17 years. Her daughter has signed for Al Nasser's taekwondo team. Not that long ago, being a professional athlete would have been an impossible career path for a teenage girl in Saudi. Now we can do whatever we want. And sure, there are rules, but we can do everything. We can drive, drink coffee outdoors, smoke, everything. The game, inevitably, is not particularly competitive. Al Nasser score in the 13th minute and dominate without producing many scoring opportunities. Ronaldo mostly walks around offside with the calculated lethargy of an apex predator. But when he does come to life, a deceptive run behind the defense, a deft flicked pass, his superiority is obvious. Champions League teams may no longer want him, but here, anyone can see he's the best player on the pitch. Halftime comes and goes. The Game of Thrones theme plays throughout the stadium. The crowd is getting a little distracted. As a spectacle, it's all extremely polite, delivered with broadcast polish. Watching on TV, you'd struggle to tell it apart from a midweek game in any European league, except minor details like Al Nasser's sleeve sponsor being a brand of camel's milk. Then, in the 77th minute, Ronaldo latches onto a free ball in the penalty box and fires a goal from a tight angle. He leaps into his customary celebration and the whole place erupts in unison. See you! Drums. Phones are out. Everybody's bouncing. Then, a few minutes later, he scores again. An absolute golazo. The Al Akdud goalkeeper is caught off his line when the ball bobbles loose and Ronaldo, 35 yards out, hits a perfect arcing lob over four opposing players to put Al Nasser up 3-0. The stadium loses their minds. Within minutes, highlights of the goal are trending worldwide on X. This is what a reported $200 million a year gets you. After the final whistle, there's a festival atmosphere. A few rows below me, a father is carrying his little girl, waving a flag together. Everyone is proud of Ronaldo, of the league, of their country. Everyone thanks the crown prince by name and says how grateful they are. For Saudis, at least, this all seems to be working. Bread and circuses. That's what the Roman poet Juvenal wrote around AD 100 of the means that the emperors used to pacify their subjects. Spending time at Al Owl Park, I can't help but think of the Colosseum and its menagerie of imported delights. Are you not entertained? Here's the thing about sports washing. People act like Saudi Arabia is investing billions of dollars in sports as an apology, a way of distracting the world when the regime silences dissidents. Maybe it isn't about that at all. Maybe it really is that buying up the world's soccer stars is a way to bring in tourists and foreign investment and make the kingdom even more money. The dissidents, after all, are still being imprisoned as brutally as ever. Maybe it's saying to a populace of 32 million Saudis who have watched pro-democracy uprisings on social media, we'll give you all that you could ever possibly want, except freedom. Everything in the kingdom is new. Everything can be remade, just not the people in charge. Maybe it's just that a load of princes with limitless money got bored of buying giga-yachts and Da Vinci's and thought it'd be fun to have a sports league. And maybe for a lot of Saudis, that doesn't matter. When you've come as far as they have, as quickly, this all must indeed seem like a miracle. And if they felt any other way, they certainly wouldn't be reckless enough to tell me. It's a country that the world has been calling on to change and open up, and now that it has, everybody's knocking it. You can't have it both ways. Nora, the SBL's chief operating officer, tells me over lunch on the grounds of At Turayf, a beautiful 18th century ruin recently remade into a shiny new tourism complex. They get no credit for the transformation they've been through already. But then the depth of that transformation is the whole point. In December, Turkey's Football Federation was scheduled to host its Super Cup final between Galatasaray and Fenerbahce in Riyadh at Al Awl, in fact, but postponed the game at the last minute after the Saudis reportedly refused to let players wear shirts and carry signs referring to Atatürk, the country's founder. Atatürk being the guy who brought democracy to Turkey. Some changes happen more slowly than others. Whether the SPL's big experiment will work long term is anybody's guess. A few years back, China got big into soccer and even signed a few superstars, only to lose interest and see most of them move back a couple of years later. That could still happen here. It's unlikely. If anything, this is only the beginning. In October, FIFA announced that Saudi Arabia is the sole country bidding to host the 2034 World Cup. Prior to the announcement, FIFA President Gianni Infantino was photographed hanging out with MBS at a boxing match and at the World Cup in Qatar. Shortly after Saudi Arabia's bid was announced, the Times of London reported that FIFA was negotiating a new sponsorship deal worth up to $100 million a year with the state-backed oil company Saudi Aramco. When reached by GQ, FIFA declined to comment, citing a policy not to confirm or deny commercial discussions. Even if Michael Emenalo can't persuade them to join, the superstars will end up in Saudi eventually. The Saudi government has already announced plans to build several new stadiums and move one of its clubs to Neom, the Crown Prince's new $500 billion megacity project that will, among other things, supposedly be powered entirely by renewable energy and staffed by robots. With that kind of investment, it's hard to see how other leagues stand a chance. It's a great advantage, Nora tells me. The audacity of the whole project is that we can deliver what we set our minds to. We're not hindered by virtually anything. Looked at another way, perhaps the SPL and soccer are perfect for each other. Players have always followed the highest bidder. Few really care as much for their clubs as they'd like us to believe. Think about it. You have a hermetic life, shuttling back and forth between matches and training, coming out in public for 90 minutes at a time. Here you can do so in air-conditioned luxury, away from the prying eyes of magazine journalists, and retire at 30 with enough money to buy a small country. Homosexual acts are illegal in Saudi Arabia, but we're talking about a sport where out of 2,500 or so active male players in the top five European leagues, only one has felt able to come out as gay. When Eminalo first started persuading players to come to Saudi last summer, he says it was a challenge. These days, players WhatsApp one another asking how they can come. We are talking before the January transfer window, but Eminalo says he has at least 7 superstars waiting to sign. They've seen the level of competition, and they've now heard from their friends that life is good and that there's nothing to worry about, Eminalo says. So their concern now is, did we miss the gravy train? To be honest, Mitrovic, the Al Hilal striker, tells me, this country, for me, I think is the future. After the game at Al Owl Park, the media hang around in the mixed zone, hoping to speak to Ronaldo. A couple of Al Akdud players come out to talk to the cameras. Al Nasser's all-stars, however, stay in the changing room. Despite the players' contracts, nobody at the Pro League seems to have required them to give post-game interviews, so they don't. When Ronaldo eventually does appear in his boxers, he disappears down another tunnel just as quickly. A disaffected crew member from the state broadcaster grumbles, "No one ever stops." Outside, the air is getting cold. Sand is blowing in from the desert, dusting the departing traffic. A crowd of young fans have assembled around the exit, waiting for the team bus, hoping to get a glimpse of Ronaldo. But it's too late. He came in a private car and has already gone. And that concludes Can the Saudis Buy Soccer? By Oliver Franklin Wallace. All right, dear listeners, I have a confession to make. As your host, I misjudged the length of that article. It was significant, and the article instructing us all on how we can buy our own sports team is quite lengthy itself. So we'll pick up with that article next week and fill in here with the time we have remaining with a series of shorter soccer-related articles from the GQ's Class of 2023 Men of the Year UK version. A Match of the Day presenter and England footballing legend has fought for his right to be opinionated on politics. In doing so, he's making the case for current and former players to speak their minds. Gary Lineker has thoughts about that, by Jack King. In March this year, Gary Lineker tweeted, back when it was still called tweeting, comparing the government's dehumanizing rhetoric on the small boats crisis to the language wielded against Jews by Germany in the 1930s. What followed was a furious row over political impartiality for BBC presenters, a walkout in solidarity by his Match of the Day colleagues, and yet another example of Lineker's unexpectedly essential place in British cultural discourse. The only irritating thing was the journalist stood outside my house from 7 in the morning till 11 at night, Lineker recalls. My boys were great. They came and we walked the dog. Every time I did, I was followed. It was a really strange experience. Where did your willingness to speak out come from? I think it's gradually crept in. I don't think I was like that. Certainly, in my 20s, I was a fairly cold, driven, ambitious footballer. Insular, probably. And then, I don't know, kids change things. Lots of things that happen to you in your life change you. My eldest was seriously ill when he was a baby. You start to develop more of a social conscience. I think as you get older, certainly with me, you get softer. I cry at films more, and I never would have done that when I was young. Did you have people coming up to you during the row? Not one person during the whole thing. I got a couple of anonymous letters in green ink and all that kind of thing. They were pretty racist, what they were saying. But that was it. Out in the streets, everyone was going, "Oh, we're with you." I got applauded in M&S, which was absolutely cringeworthy. I didn't know what to do with myself. What do you think of the Keep Politics Out of Sport Brigade? It's an absurdity, and the only time people ever say it is if they disagree with what you're talking about. Everyone's absolutely happy with you having all sorts of opinions if they agree with them. The minute they don't, they say, "Oh, why don't you stick to football?" Which is obviously nonsense, because politics seeps into everything. But it generally is the same people. I'm a fairly centrist person, so if the people on the far right are having a pop, you must be doing something right. Do you ever get bored of football? I don't. It's the one ever-present in my life. Lineker is 63. I had kids at a certain age. I was married for a lot of time. My parents are no longer here. Football is the one thing that's been there the whole way through, and I'm not one of these old players who thinks it's not as good as it was. It's massively improved. How will it change technologically over the next 20 years? I think they'll simplify the handball law, because at the minute, they're just tying themselves up in knots with it. Like they do in other sports, we'll hear the conversation between the referee and the VAR, but automated offside will be the one. It's already semi-automated. Beyond that, technology can't decide whether it's a free kick or not, but who knows with AI. How long do you have left doing Match of the Day? I've got 2 years left, contractually. Beyond that, it depends on the rights, because the BBC have got to keep winning the rights to show the highlights. The Premier League have been very clever, making sure that there is a show on terrestrial television to maintain interest in the sport, as still over half the public don't have Sky or BT, so hopefully that will continue. Would you have tweeted again, knowing the consequences? I wouldn't, purely because it was pitched as me versus the BBC, and I'm part of the team at the BBC. And I love the BBC. For all its difficulties and problems, it's an incredible institution. It's something we should be massively proud of, and sometimes we rubbish it. Okay, here's another soccer meets politics piece. Again from GQ, and their Men of the Year honorees, although this one's a woman. Jenny Hermoso has a bigger goal in mind. After she unwittingly found herself at the center of Spanish football's sexism scandal, the forward turned her darkest moment into a movement for change. And this is an interview by Patricia Moreno. For Jenny Hermoso, 20 August 2023 will always be a day to savor, the day on which she and her Spanish women's football teammates bested England 1-0 in a dogged and dramatic World Cup final. But it was also the day her name became synonymous with a moment and movement that reverberated to all corners of the sporting world. As a global audience watched the Spanish team celebrating their triumph, Luis Rubiales, the then head of the Spanish Football Association, grabbed Hermoso and kissed her on the lips as she lined up to collect her winner's medal. Though Spain were crowned champions, Rubiales' actions cast a deep shadow over their victory. The event led to one of the most chaotic press conferences in memory, with a defiant and unhinged Rubiales refusing to resign, a move that only served to increase the global outpouring of support for Hermoso. The team took immediate action, refusing to play international games. That decision incited the feminist movement Se Acabo, It's Over, throughout the country and beyond. Manager Jorge Vilda has since been sacked, and Rubiales eventually resigned after being suspended by FIFA amid an ongoing investigation to decide whether he will be prosecuted for sexual assault. Hermoso, meanwhile, has become the unfortunate yet steadfast face of a historical moment that has drawn attention to an ugly side of the beautiful game, one that female footballers routinely and unjustly experience. Given what happened when you won the World Cup, how have you been able to get through everything? At the beginning, it was hard to understand what was going on, the movement that was unleashed. I'm very grateful for the fact that so many people were on my side, on our side. Actresses, footballers, some of our rivals at the World Cup, including England, who we beat in the final. It all gave me the strength to carry on and go through this for everyone. Is there anyone in particular who has been there for you? I was lucky to have my brother attend the World Cup in Australia. He witnessed me become world champion, but he suddenly got tangled up in this affair and experienced everything firsthand with me. He is my brother, my family, but he's also a man who supports the cause, and that to me is all the more valuable. Having him by my side amid all this mess has been essential to my peace of mind. Through all the adversity, what are you most proud of? Thanks to football, our voices are being heard, and with that voice, we can change so many lives, probably more than we're aware of. Since we became world champions, our voice is even louder. Personally, I don't fight for status. I will never fight just for money. If I have to lend my face to press for change, I'll do it. Things don't necessarily have to be as they've always been. Even before the World Cup, you and your teammates came under a lot of unwarranted criticism for making a stand for what you believed in. It has always been said that we wanted to be paid the same as the male players, but that's not true. We simply wanted the basics, to have a minimum wage, to be respected, and to be given the opportunity to be able to do something very big. There is a phrase that has stuck with me since winning the World Cup. Despite everything, we were champions. It was pretty damning how few male players came out in support. I'm grateful to Borja Iglesias, Hector Bellerin, and Isco, who were among the first to speak out. Our philosophy as a team is to always be united and do as we feel. This is how we've achieved everything so far. How much did you engage with feminism before the Se Acabó movement? With everything that has happened, many of us have become more aware of what the word feminism really means. Feminism is a movement for equality between men and women. Machismo, on the other hand, is an attitude. I think we have a responsibility to make people understand that we don't have to continue doing things as we've done all our lives. Why do you think there are so many out gay female footballers and so few in the men's game? The lack of LGBTQ+ visibility in men's football can be explained by the prototype of the traditional footballer. I think they believe it could harm their sporting career. On the other hand, every woman who has started in football has a different mindset about this. We've been open from the very beginning. For us, it's something absolutely normal. I'd like to thank the women who started in this sport, who created that vision for all of us who came after, and who removed all the barriers so we could express ourselves freely. Have you had a chance to stop and think about the legacy you are shaping? I don't know if destiny had this in store for me or not, but it has helped me to look at life differently and realize that although I've reached the peak in my sporting career by winning a World Cup, there is much more to do. Having the voice that I have now is a real responsibility. I want to make the most of it. We have reached the end of our hour here on Men's Magazines at Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. I'm your host, Robert Streit. I have enjoyed reading for you about Saudi Arabian politics and sports and soccer in particular, and the nexus between politics and free speech and standing up for what's right while balling out, while playing the beautiful game. Oh, I look forward to reading for you again next week. Between now and then, get outside, get some exercise, take care of one another, take care of yourself. Peace.